So today, Pat, we're going to talk, we're going to cater to the 80s people. All of the Uncle Ricos out there who peaked in the 80s.
Big hair, colorful clothing.
I don't know. I just have this thing with the 80s. I mean, I get it. We're 52.
We were teenagers.
You know, we were teenagers, man. But I don't, my heart is with the 70s. It always was, always will be. But you know, we get a lot of feedback from people. It says, you know, you got to do more 80s stuff, more 80s bands, more 80s band related shows, talk about stuff. So I, you know, we're the next two episodes, which this episode is going to, this is a double episode. The albums deserve their own spotlight. The songs deserve their own spotlight. I'm not going to go with the obvious, man. I don't want to talk about, like, you know, because look, let's face it. Majority of the 80s for us, I would guess this would be true for you. Maybe I'm wrong, but the majority of the 80s for me was my metal phase.
Metallica.
Is that safe to say with you?
Sure.
Yeah.
Without any hesitation.
So, I mean, I don't want to go in the obvious areas, and I want to just do something fun and just do something uncharacteristically rock under fire and just get a little corny, man, and just do the lists, the two lists I want to do, man. Well, the one really corny one, which could be corny, man, but I have no shame. I have no guilty pleasures, man. If I like it, it's good. Our top 10 pop songs of the 80s, meaning the radio, and our top 10 favorite albums, not necessarily what we think are the best albums of the 80s, but just our favorites, our personal favorites, right? So that could be anything. Totally, you can go off the charts, you can go outside the box, whatever it is. There are no rules. So I guess this episode I want to do I guess our favorite 10 albums of the entire 80s decade. Really quick before we start, we do have some, I guess we have some bad news today because we lost Christine McVie, longtime member of Fleetwood Mac. And that's a total bummer.
Big supporter of the show.
Yeah. I mean, the last time she was on, we were trying to arrange to get her back on the show before the show ends, and we've got that the problem is I had to tell her, look, let me get back to you because everybody's calling in, everybody wants to get on the fucking show. That everybody's hearing that it's our last season. We're doing this double season thing where, you know, six is going to end at the end of December. We're going to go right into seven, which is going to be the second. We're doing this like The Sopranos. We're having two halves of a final season.
And then right? We fade to black.
Remember when The Sopranos had their last season and like halfway through it, it just stopped. And then they went away for 2 years and then they came back for the rest of the final season.
Breaking Bad did the same thing.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to let it go on that long. We're actually going to siege right into the other half. The only difference is going to be the year 2022 and 2023. And we'll do the final 10 shows in 2023. It's a big loss, man. All these losses now are big, man. Anything now is just a fucking another chunk taken out of rock music.
We're not getting any younger.
Anyway, 80s albums. Yeah, I made this list. I did. I mean, I had a couple of runners up, man, because I, you know, obviously there's just there's too many fucking records to name, man. And just like all the stuff that, you know, just, I mean, some of them are just off the wall and some of them are just, they come out of nowhere. But I mean, I would be a hypocrite if I didn't mention like things like Yngwie Malmsteen's Rising Force, which put me in my bedroom and caused me to lock myself in my bedroom for like 2 years.
Yeah.
And I didn't come out for like two. Nobody saw me for 2 years from like 1984 to about 1986.
It's a good record.
And you know, so that's one of the runners up. Boston Third Stage is one of my favorite albums from the 80s.
Very underrated.
It's very underrated. I mean, like I mentioned, I think in some previous episode from the past, I like it better than the first album.
No, I don't. That, yeah.
The Cars Panorama, the third album, which I think is underrated. It doesn't get enough love. Al Di Meola's Electric Rendezvous. That has to get an honorable mention. And Pete Townsend, All the Best Cowboys Have Chinese Eyes, one of his better works, man. I think Pete Townsend, my favorite Pete Townsend writing period is from like 1975 to 85, which is kind of crazy to say if you're a Who fan. Like, not many people would say that, but I think like Townsend was at his most prolific in the early 80s, and he was definitely saving his best stuff for his solo albums and not for the Who. All right, so that said, the first album I'm going to go with, I guess we'll come in at number 10, and I get it, man. You don't want to, maybe you're not going numerical order, but we're still doing 10 records. So, is going to be Sandinista by the Clash. And, it was, after coming off of London Calling, which is their, you know, probably their single, if you had to pick one masterpiece from the Clash, it's, I think the consensus is London Calling. So you follow up a double album with a triple album, and you spend like half of that stuff in an experimental phase of electronic music and whatever they call that stuff, dub and ska, and going it off in all these directions and just shattering what you wanted to believe was punk. You know, and whatever the rules and constraints and the uniform of punk was. And let's face it, man. If there are any greater posers than metalheads, they were the punks. So Sandinista was monumental. I might dare say just as monumental as London Calling. Not as good as London Calling, but good enough to put in my top 10.
Definitely. I remember once saying I wish a lot of the newer generation found the Clash. I think I said it on one of our Christmas specials.
Mm. You played one of their songs.
Yeah, I don't remember what one it was, though. I'm going to come in with my first one. It's highly influential to me, getting into, really getting my motor going for metal. And that's Blizzard of Oz from Ozzy. You know, I growing up in the 70s, you knew what Black Sabbath was, and you know, you hear Ozzy's leaving the band or is kicked out of the band, fired, however you want to put it. And then along comes Ozzy with one of the hottest guitar players in all the land, and it's just I had that on cassette probably 3 times because I just wore it out. I was not a vinyl guy back then, obviously, I was a teenager. But man, that album just, I mean, from beginning to end, there's not a bad song on it. And it introduced you, or me at least, to a softer side of metal, you know, like D. And there was this classical stuff on it that was like, wow, what is this? And it was like, kind of reminds me of, I know it was Van Halen that they played in the movie Back to the Future, but that's kind of like what this record did for me, really, with Randy. It was like an alien, you know what I mean? You were like, whoa, what, you know, mind blowing.
I tend to like offend metalheads sometimes with my comments, but picking up on what you said, I think Randy Rhoads was too intelligent. It was too intelligent for metal. Like, you know what I mean? And that's not a mock on metal. It was, like you said, it was a softer side of metal,
yeah,
where he was doing things that the average metal band could not comprehend on a musical theoretical level.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And that's why the best guitarists and the most adventurous bands are not afraid to go where Ozzy goes on Blizzard of Oz.
Yeah.
Right. So while some people say, well, what do you mean too intelligent for metal? That's a compliment to Randy, and that's a compliment to Ozzy, and it's a compliment to that album. That album made my top 10 list of favorite debut albums, if you may remember. You know, I mean, I put Blizzard right up there in my top 5 or 6. And it's an album I love. And, you know, it didn't make my top 10 favorites of the 80s, but it's definitely an honorable mention. I should have said that. But yeah, it's a great album, man. Dude, what do you, I don't know if I asked you this. What do you prefer, Blizzard or Diary?
Blizzard.
Yeah.
I'm not taking anything away from Diary, but just it you know, for me, to be honest with you, they're so close. But it's where I was, what I was doing, that made me play that cassette that much more, and who I was with, you know, that just it gives that squeaks it out for me.
And that's why I asked the question, man, because it's like both of them are so, I mean, both of them are just like definitively Ozzy that,
yeah.
I mean, it's crazy because you look back at the catalog that he accumulated over the past 30 years now, 40 years, right? 42 years since Blizzard, at least a dozen albums, a dozen and a half albums, right? All these years, even Zach is a legend now. I remember when Zach was the new guitarist. I mean, it's crazy to remember a time when there was only Blizzard of Oz and Diary of a Madman. You know what I mean? I remember that well when he only had those two albums.
Well, and then when Randy died, he did a tour real quick with Brad Gillis, and you had the Speak of the Devil record. Speak of
the Devil, which just happened to come out 40 years ago this week.
Yeah, and it was just all Sabbath songs with Brad Gillis playing them, and that one was just like, whoa, okay, this is fucking killer.
Speak of the Devil, Ozzy Osbourne, man, Brad Gillis, and another one. Like I have to mention, I thought maybe we should do an episode on it, but I don't think we're going to. But we have to acknowledge the almighty Thriller, which is 40 years old today, or tomorrow, or sometime this week. Thriller turns 40.
Hopefully enough people who listen to our show know the rock history behind that record. I'm not talking just Eddie Van Halen, because that record was programmed, partially produced. All the keyboards were programmed basically by Toto. It's basically a Toto record.
Well, with it's Michael Jackson singing. And
Vaccaro and the other guy,
Steve Lukather.
Lukather,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those guys helped. Without them, that album is not what it is. So I think our folks out there are savvy enough to know that. I mean, you know, everybody wants to run right to Eddie, and yeah, it's a fantastic solo on Beat It.
I mean, it's a 30-second moment on that album. I mean, Eddie, you know, Eddie gets a lot of it because from the rock audience, man, the rock crowd.
But to hear Steve Lukather's guitar on there and the way he programmed it, like, you could look out.
That's a Toto album. It's a Toto album with Michael Jackson singing.
Sure.
if you want to look at it that way, you can look at it that way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's
kind of like Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell. It's an E Street Band album with Meatloaf singing.
Yeah.
You know, well, with and Todd Rundgren and, on guitar.
Yeah. You know? And was Steinman on that thing at all, or did he just write it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you got Gary Talent and Roy Bittman and Max Weinberg. So, anyway. All right. So... All right, great pick, man. You're not going to like my next one. Life's Too Good by the Sugar Cubes. The first Sugar Cubes album, man. I won't say too much about that, but when the summer I graduated high school, summer of 88, very interesting summer for me. And I remember watching postmodern MTV, and there was a show called 120 Minutes, and I saw this weird band called the Sugar Cubes, this weird song called Cold Sweat, and it had this weird singer from Iceland, and I could not pronounce her name, and I was like, what's her name? Bjork. But anyway,
the parrot looking lady,
I went out, got that record. I was like, this is where I need to go musically. Great album. I'm not one of those people that followed her into her solo career. I'm not really a fan. I can appreciate what she does, but it's not for me. And nor were the other Sugar Cubes records that, you know, the follow-up record. And if they may have done another one, I'm not sure if they would probably have broken up by then, by 92, when Bjork's, I think her first solo record came out. I don't know, but I do love the first Sugar Cubes album, Life's Too Good. Anyway.
There you go. you definitely, I wouldn't say that I hate it, but I don't know too much about it. So that's, I'm not going to knock it.
You don't have to comment.
I'm not going to knock it just for the sake of knocking it.
I have a lot of odds and ends on here, man. My favorite stuff is not what I was, what you would guess would be.
That's interesting.
I have a lot of solo artists.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
My next pick is, I'm going to go into the Police a little bit. Synchronicity.
Right.
Yeah. Just a huge record for them. Obviously, I like a lot of their older stuff, but I mean, if you think back to that, to when Synchronicity came out, you heard it everywhere. There wasn't a moment, you know, it made every critic's top 10 list. It made every fan's top 10 list. All the while they were falling apart. You know what I mean? They were on the verge of hating each other, but there's just, it was a hard pick for that record. But I just, you know, the more and more I looked over it, I was like, yeah, that's going to be the one.
Remember, I always think about like, and Synchronicity is not my favorite Police record, but it was obviously their peak of popularity. And I always think back of when,
I think that's why I picked it.
Remember when you said Radiohead, man, every time there's a fucking Radiohead album, it's always like, here's Radiohead. And you know, like here everybody stop. Everybody bow down. Radiohead's here. That. Radiohead has a new record, you know? And I remember being a kid and the two big album releases that where they acted like it was like stop the world. Everybody stop what they're doing. U2 has the Joshua Tree out, right?
It's on my list.
And the police have Synchronicity out. Like that's the way it was just like stop. The
Joshua Tree. Joshua Tree. I might as well go right to my next one because that's my next one is the Joshua Tree.
Yeah. And then after the Joshua Tree, every fucking Radiohead album.
Yeah.
So basically
they were critics' darlings for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I got Synchronicity the Christmas after it came out. Great album. It's not my favorite. I always liked Mother, the Andy Summers song, Mother.
Yeah.
And I mean, the whole thing, I mean, the majority of it is on the radio. So it's like unplayable for me. You know, it's just,
I just think it moves. It moved so well.
T and like Sahara is good. Walking my footsteps, like
the rhythms in it is just. I love the way like all of it just gelled together.
Sting is just so far musically superior to most of his like
peers.
And I'm not even a fan. Like I'm not a fan of his solo stuff at all.
No, I am not either.
To some of it recently, man, and I was just like, what the fuck. Like that Ricciardo who interviewed Sting about like all of like there's that song Fortress Around Your Heart.
Yeah.
And before he even gets through the first verse, the thing is changed key three different times.
Yeah, the dude's a fucking virtuoso.
Anyway, man. All right. Great album, man. Synchronicity. All right. I'm gonna go with my number eight is Suzanne Vega's first record. Big pick, fan actually. Of Suzanne Vega over the years, man. She's just, I mean, one of the two or three most underrated singer-songwriters of our time, man.
I agree with that statement.
Probably one of my five favorite solo artists, beginning to end, man. I love that record. I'm not going to specify or get too much into detail, but if you just want, you know, just mellow, minor key, moody, beautiful songwriting, man, just, you know, you listen to it and you kind of get the sense of the seasons, man. Like there's some songs that are very wintry, you know, some of them are just like you listen and you fucking feel like there's like leaves falling on you, man. It's like you feel like you're outside. And I don't know if that sounds too corny, man, but it's very, very moody music, man.
But it's amazing when an artist can get you to put you in that space.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not many people that can do that. She's not that for me. I would guess that Dylan is that kind of guy for you too, that puts you in a specific space. But there are artists that put me in those spaces, and I think that's the beauty of music is how we all
Yeah.
We all find a different vibe from somebody different. And I like that. That was a great way of explaining what that record does for you.
Someone like Dylan would not do that, because I'm so familiar with him that he's like somebody that you know so well, like a family member. Like sometimes you just want to tell your brother to get the fuck out of the room. Just go away, go somewhere, shut up already. You know what I mean? Like, leave me alone. Like, you, when you know somebody that well and you're just kind of like, all right. There's a guy, George Winston, man. He's the guy that plays the piano, and he has all of those seasonal albums. Like, one is called Autumn, another's called Winter, another's called, you get it. But yeah. It's moody like that, man. Almost like Victorian, like this Victorian sound, man, where you're just like running through this like gray field with fucking mist all around you, man. And so, yeah, without getting much cornier. All right, you're up.
All right, so this one's tough. I my favorite Metallica record is the one I'm going to go with here. I get a lot of flack for it. It's Injustice for All. It's 89. It's post Cliff Burton.
Right.
I love it just because it's so riff heavy. I have to mention, however, I guess this is one of my honorable mentions, that Kill 'Em All in 82, there was a cassette that was floating around. I was in junior high school. And that cassette floating around, or maybe 83 it was, whatever it was. It could have been 83. The cassette floating around, only because it was like their EP, and it only had four songs on it, which went on to become Kill 'Em All. So I got to throw Kill 'Em All out there, because that record was like the one that introduced you to that band and made you realize like there's something different coming. But as far as Metallica records go, and Justice for All, every song is probably 7 to 8 minutes long, maybe longer. It's just the crunch of that record. And yeah, there's some complaints about it. It's very light on the bottom end. You know, like, you know, I think Neustadt has even said like his bass, you can hardly hear it punch through. But I don't know.
I think he's gone as far as to say that they literally removed him from the record.
I don't know if they did that. It's just, he's playing in sync with James basically.
Yeah.
But it's just, the riff, every riff, it's so tight too, and just sounds like mechanicalized almost. I totally dig that record. So I'm going to go with Injustice for All, but I wanted to throw that honorable mention out there for Kill 'Em All.
And it's probably far darker than the first three records combined, man. Just like in terms of like mood, you know, Blackened and
Dyer's Eve
and One. Yeah. I mean, remember Harvester when One came out, man? And how depressing Sorrows. Just watching the video was.
Yeah, Harvester One. Of Sorrows. I mean, it's. Yeah, it's definitely the writing definitely took a different turn as far as lyrics go.
All right, my number seven comes out of nowhere, man. But it's just pure pop bliss, and that's all it is. It's just ear candy, and that's "Mad Love" by Linda Ronstadt. That's an album that 2 years ago I wouldn't have put on this list. This album probably wouldn't have been anywhere near a top 10 list of mine 2 years ago. But it was my Pandemic record. And it's an album that I had known my whole life, right? And it's an album that I've had since I was 10. And it's an album that I probably played more in the last 2 years than I have in the last 40. And it's basically her last rock album, where she made a big string of really good pop rock albums in the mid to late 70s, you know, with Peter Asher producing just some of the best produced albums of the 70s, and one after another. And then she kind of made her quote unquote new wave record, where she cut her hair, and now she was going to be making music like that was written by Nick Lowe and Elvis Costello, and she was doing things like Party Girl and Mad Love, and she even did a remake of Hurt So Bad, which is like, which kills me, man. It's like one of the most powerful remakes ever.
She left the SoCal boys behind.
yeah. And so yeah, that's a really good one that I like enough to put on this list.
I'm gonna go with Number of the Beast. That it's another album that I just See, I used to ride around on bikes with a couple of my buddies, and we would bring our boom box with us. And when I say cassette, that's, you know, that's another, the cassette that we played over and over and over again till it was smudged off. You knew every song. It was just tremendous, man, from beginning to end. I could still listen. I could still sit down and listen to that record. I can't even hear what you're. Mike's playing guitar.
I'm glad you can't hear. You know why?
Why?
Because if that was audible, YouTube would shut us down.
They'd flag it. What were you playing? Were you playing Number of the Beast?
I was playing Number of the Beast.
But I know that you're a Maiden guy too, so you're probably in agreement with at least a Maiden record.
I have this argument with my 8-year-old nephew every time I see him. Okay, I argue with an 8-year-old over what Maiden's best album is. Right? He likes Seventh Son. Seventh Son is his favorite. I mean, Seventh Son was one of his first. He's been holding, like, he used to grab the cover when he was 2 years old, when he was a baby, when he could barely like do anything, and he would just like look at it for hours. And then he started finally listening to it. And you know, Peace of Mind has always been my favorite Maiden.
Yeah.
And we just, again, on Thanksgiving, we had the same argument. We were like, no, this one's better. But this one has this song on it. And this one has, you know, so, and he's like a little me, I guess, because he say things that only I would say, you know. Number six, one of your favorites, Lou Reed. New York. New York is a record that when you listen to today, although it's one of my favorite records of all time, when you listen to it today, it sounds dated. The music doesn't sound dated. The lyrics sound dated because it is.
Because they cleaned up New York.
Yeah. Well, it's a much different era of New York City. But if you want an audio musical documentation of New York City in the 1980s, that's what you listen to. You watch Do the Right Thing and you listen to New York. New York at the end of the Koch era, going into the Dinkins era, Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing and Lou Reed's New York. The best
fair.
Two artistic documents of New York City. In the late 80s.
Yeah, you could take that back a little bit. Probably the earlier decade would be Fort Apache, the Bronx, as far as a film.
And the message from Grandmaster Flash would accompany that, man.
Yeah, sure, right? Because, yeah. Wow, that's
I even argued when I put out the Springsteen Lennon book a few years back, in one of the last chapters, I argue that the message and New York, like Lou Reed's New York and Grandmaster Flash, the message are two bookends for the 80s, like two musical bookends that kind of, you know, if you had to have like a musical New York Times.
It paints a wild picture. Absolutely, yeah. Man. It really does. That's really good. That's I agree wholeheartedly with that.
So that's my number six.
I'm going to go with I picked this one because of a certain song on the record. It's a Bruce record. I'm going to go with Born in the USA because when I hear one of my top five favorite songs from him is easily My Hometown. So like it just, I don't know. I got a vibe from that song and obviously we're both Bruce guys. I could have picked any Bruce song from any Bruce album from the 80s. I leaned a little towards that one though. I the river was always up there as well, but I just felt like Born in the USA, like shot him to the stratosphere. If he wasn't already famous, I mean, he was famous, obviously, but Born in the USA put him on a whole nother level.
That was when we lost Bruce to the world.
Yeah, right. He wasn't just for Jersey anymore. It was everybody knows this guy now.
Yeah.
I mean, you think like, you know, because MTV was so popular, wildly popular then. The first chords of Born in the USA alone, and you knew the video was coming. You're like, oh my God, this is, what is this? But My Hometown is the reason why I gave the slight nod to that album. Just the whole story of sitting on his dad's lap and driving through town. And, you know, it's crazy. I just, it brings me back to a moment.
Nice, man. Nice. I excluded Bruce from all lists. Like, I have a problem putting Bruce on a list because it wouldn't be fair. Because, like the first, my top four would be The River through Tunnel of Love, you know?
Yeah, but you know something? These are our lists.
Yeah.
And there's enough out there from both of our, for both of our lists that yeah. other people are going to agree with. And I'm going to, you know, yeah. if it's my decade, I yeah. definitely have to throw that out there. I have to put that
yeah,
on.
Yeah, no,
there.
Of course.
That being said, I see your meaning behind not putting them on there. No.
I just do it to be fair to the other artists, man. Like, if I had to do a real one where I was going to be judged on it or something, or, you know, if like NPR or like the Nobel Prize was going to judge it or something, and I yeah. put it on. All right. So number five would be, I'm probably the only person that puts this on a top 10 list of anything. Music from the Elder by Kiss. I've always championed that record, man. I did an episode on it last year saying how it was the most underrated album of the 80s. I just love it, man. I love everything about it. I'm not going to keep going about that. Cause again, if you want to hear me talk about the Elder, Stick Nixon and I did an episode about it like a year ago. Okay. So what you got?
I'll go with the cheese fest. Asia.
All right. Nice one, man.
Just something about that brings me back to that decade again, MTV decade. Obviously, we're in the 80s. But Heat of the Moment, man, that was just such a really just – I felt like a really important song for that band. And I think that, you know, obviously being members of Yes, you knew they were all well-rounded. Look at that. He's showing his vinyl for you guys out there in the listening world.
The first two Asia records.
And just to, I just felt it was important for those guys to put that out. You know what I mean? To move away from what they were doing or what they had done. And it was certainly different. And I mean, we always talk about like musicians and super groups and bands and stuff like that. Those guys are easily some of the best.
I saw Asia, man.
Now that's a story.
I saw Asia on the Alpha Tour. Not yeah, the second record.
Hang on one second. I have to let my dog out.
All right. While you do that, man, I'm going to just go into my next thing.
Okay. That's fine.
Yeah. I'm just trying to save time here.
No, don't right. worry about the time, Mike. Don't press it for time. I was right. giving you a roundabout.
Yeah.
I want to hear the record first so that I can come back and at least discuss it with you.
Okay. All right. I mean, it's a Dylan album.
Oh, never mind.
All right. So while Pat's going off to walk the dog, I'm going to be talking about my number four, which is Oh Mercy from Bob Dylan. And I mean, I could probably, like so many people, I'd probably write a book about Bob somehow, some way. I'm not sure it would be a very good one, but Bob's catalog is voluminous, man. It's like, it's just like opening up an encyclopedia. Every record is a volume of an encyclopedia, but Oh Mercy is an album that he put out at the end of the 80s, and it was mostly like love / breakup / heartbreak songs, man. And the thing is, every good Dylan album through the 70s and 80s was always, okay, it's his best album since Blood on the Tracks. It's his best album since Blood on the Tracks. It's his best album since Blood on the Tracks. This album, in my opinion, was not only his best album since Blood on the Tracks. I've always said a very controversial thing among Dylan fans. It's better than Blood on the Tracks. Anyway, it's that good. I champion this album over so many Dylan albums. I wouldn't dare say it's his best album, but it's probably my favorite Dylan album. And that includes his stuff in the 60s too.
That's strong. I'm going to go with Scarecrow by John Mellencamp. Just, you know, the opening line from the title song, Scarecrow on a Wooden Cross, Blackbird in the Barn, I think he took his songwriting to the level where he wanted it to be all along, from Johnny Cougar, from John Cougar Mellencamp to just John Mellencamp. And Scarecrow, man, you believe every, like you know, like you said before with Suzanne Vega, she brought you to different places. You felt like you were on that farm. You felt like you were, you know, he brought you to places that you would, I've never been to Indiana. I've never been out there, you know, and he brought you there.
Yeah.
And I just think it was more, I guess it was more pop than Bruce always was, but they kind of have a similar message out there. You know, they're for the working guy. At least I feel that way. I just think that, I don't know, for some reason, Mellencamp went more, it got more pop, more, is that, I don't even know if that's fair of me saying.
Yes and no.
And I don't know why that
is. You know what it is? I've thought about this, what Radio you're saying. Friendly. I've thought about this a lot. And I could never pinpoint exactly what it is when you compare that to Bruce. But an example I can give you would be that a lot of Bruce's popular songs aren't really all that commercial, and neither are Mellencamp's. But the most popular Mellencamp songs, he's got far more in the sense of, like, there's Pink Houses and R-O-C-K in the USA and things like that. And Bruce has Glory Days, and that, like, John Mellencamp has a bunch of Glory Days, which makes it appear like he's more commercial than Bruce, but he's almost really not, because they're all three chord rock songs anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense.
Where
yeah, sure it does.
And Scarecrow, man, I agree with everything. I don't know that he's made a better album than that.
No.
Human Wheels came close, I think. But,
very good record. That's a very good record as well.
And the reason I like both is because I love the minor keys. I love the minor chords, man. Rain on the Scarecrow, man. Human Wheels later on, about 10 years later. Yeah, man. It's a powerful album.
Yeah. Even the album cover.
Political, man. It's commercial. It rocks. You know, now, if he made this record today, man, you'd have Fox News calling for boycotts. Oh, how dare you? All right. But anyway, number three, Screaming for Vengeance.
Judas Priest, man.
It's really like all the metal I listened to in the 80s, it's really the one. You know, Peace of Mind might be another one, but Screaming for Vengeance is really the one that has resonated all through the decades, man, and sticks with me. It's my favorite Judas Priest album. I think it's Priest at their absolute peak. It's my favorite metal album.
Yeah.
It's just the quintessential, my definition of the greatness of metal. I never got into thrash. I stopped in terms of heaviness and speed. I could never go any heavier than Metallica. I could never get into thrash. Screaming for Vengeance does it for me, man. From that opening, you know, the Hellion Electric Eye, you play that motherfucker loud. Yeah. You turn that shit up. You crank that shit in the car. You crank it at home. Wherever the fuck you're playing it, you crank it, right? It's the ultimate loud album. Top volume, ear splitting metal as Priest defined it in 1982, arguably the golden age of metal, 80 through 83, arguably the golden age of metal, both in the UK and in the States. So that's my number three.
I'm gonna go into the later 80s again, 88. Operation Mindcrime.
Shit, I was just about to say, man. I was just about to say Operation Mindcrime.
Is it on your list?
No.
Oh.
You know why I reacted like that?
Why?
Because I forgot it. Because I forgot it. It's an honorable mention.
Okay. For me, this record,
oh my God.
I looked at it like, you know, let's talk about labels for a second. We were looked at as stoners, as metalheads, as boneheads.
Boneheads.
It was a very, very smart record by an amazingly talented band that took a concept record and brought it to metalheads. You know, there's no mistaking the fact that you and I are Pink Floyd fans. So we knew the idea of a concept album. You know, we were listening to it, smoking dope in our parents' garage. Maybe not you, maybe me, whatever. So for a metal band to put a concept record out that good, I was blown away by it, and to this day, it stands the test of time. It doesn't sound underproduced. Like, I feel like a lot of stuff sounds underproduced now because of the capability that we have to play it. But man, just a tremendous, tremendous record. There's not a bad song on it, really. It's just so well done, well produced, well written, well played.
I don't know how I forgot it, man, but it wouldn't make my top 10, but it would just scrape my top 10. You know, it gets an honorable mention, so I should have really mentioned that. I mean, that was such a pivotal time for me, man. It's a pivotal record for me because I got really into Bob Dylan by way of Queensryche. You know, an album like Queensryche, it was a very like Rage for Order first, but Mind Crime was an intelligent record, man. It was informed politics for me, man.
But what you just mentioned there, because you would not expect Operation Mindcrime to come from Rage for Order, right? Because I was a fan of that album.
Yeah.
And then they hit you with that and you're like, holy Christ,
I mean, I like Rage, probably like Rage for Order more, but there was something very political about them. And then when they I was 17, 18. It was just before my 18th birthday. It was a week. It came out a week before my 18th birthday. We were looking at graduation a month later, you know, in May of 1988. And when I listened to the first three or four songs, I knew that they were railing against the Reagan administration. I saw something. I was like, oh my God, eradicate the fascists. And now we're talking about fascism creeping its way back into Washington, you know, by way of fucking, you know, MAGA. And so when I heard Queensryche doing this stuff, man, and like, yeah, 7 years of power, the corporation claw, the rich control the government, the media, the law, to make some kind of difference, everyone must know, eradicate the fascist revolution will grow, right?
It's amazing.
Speak the word. The word is all of us, right? Spreading the disease, man. The fucking, this, the lyrics on that record blew my fucking mind, and it left me hungry for more. And only Bob Dylan later that summer could feed that hunger, right? And so, I can't. Well, thank you, man, because I really forgot Operation Mindcrime, man.
Got to let the dog in again. Hang on.
All right. So I'll go with my number two over here. Murmur from REM, the first REM record. Technically they had an EP called Chronic Town before that, but Murmur, it's taken me and the rest of the REM fan base almost 40 years to figure out what the hell Michael Stipe was saying in those lyrics.
I knew you were going to REM
for the internet, man. But that's all I'll say on that, man. Murmur is, the less said, the better. It's that good. And, you know,
I
either love it or you don't. But
no, I do enjoy that album. I really do. All right, I'm gonna throw one out there for my mom.
All right,
believe it or not, I'm gonna throw out there Billy Joel's "Innocent Man."
Wow, nice.
It has like that doo-wop flair to it. You know, that's his roots, obviously,
and that's what he was going for.
It was. And I respect that album a hell of a lot more as an adult than I did as a child. And that's the truth. But my mom just fell in love with it. And like every song, I remember,
you know,
her
why,
buying
right?
it. Because when of the doo-wop.
When he made that record, he set out to do the influences, the stuff that he grew up on.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is music
close
that
in age.
Our parents loved.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
The Longest Time is a doo-wop song. Uptown Girl is a tribute to Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Tell Her About It. Is it
Tell Her About
Motown?
It? Yeah.
You know, you got those, a couple of Motown songs on there.
And he had like the big wacky suits on and all the videos and shit.
Yeah.
But I respect that album a lot more as an adult than I ever did younger. Like, you kind of always be like, ah, ha, ha, and you made fun of Uptown Girl or whatever like that. But even the title track, Innocent Man, like the Innocent Man song was like, wow. Like, he belts on that, man.
Yeah, I think the older we get, we appreciate our parents' music the older we get, because it reconnects us back to childhood when we were first hearing that music.
Yeah, and now that we're getting older, it's like, wow. Yeah. I don't want to get older anymore.
So my number one, in the number one spot, a band that I turned out to not really like all that much after this album, but it is The Cult, Love.
Good
Love,
album.
The second Cult album.
But.
And, you know, after Love, they were supposed to do another album called Peace. And it was supposed to be psychedelic like Love. And then Rick Rubin came in. And they came out with a much different album. And they said, well, let's wear our influences on our sleeves and try, instead of trying to be Echo and the Bunnymen, let's play some AC/DC. And they came out with Electric and Wildflower and Love Removal Machine. And it was like those Keith Richards chords instead of the dreamy stuff you hear on Love. And Love is just one of the most beautiful psychedelic records of I guess the post-60s era, man. You know, I can't say enough good about it, but a lot of it is personal. A lot of it is sentimental, I guess, the time that I was hearing it. And it was one of those albums that pulled me right out of metal, you know. And again, when I say things like that, I don't mean that to be condescending, although, you know, sometimes it may sound like that. But it was just, I needed a change in what I was just kind of like, I was getting so bored with the formula, you know, and a lot of it just sounded new. It was fresh. It was like, yeah, you know, let me hear more of this. And so, Love by The Cult.
As we're winding down our show here, not just the daily or our weekly show here tonight, but like our show in whole. This next record is definitely going to take you by surprise, but I have to throw it up there because it's got arguably two of my favorite songs by this band on it. And that is Tattoo You by the Stones. Sleeve is probably my second favorite Rolling Stones song ever. It's just so different. Waiting on a Friend is awesome. Obviously, Start Me Up, Hang Fire. But, I mean, if I had to pick a Stones record, gun to the head, you know I'm not a huge Stones fan. I respect them immensely.
Yeah.
But that album, that would be a gun to the head, that's probably going to be the record.
If you had Slave is like, it's like driving through Harlem.
Yeah. You know? But they finish up the record with Waiting on a Friend, and that's them getting to Harlem.
Yeah.
Right? Slave is driving through the tunnel and getting down, you know, getting uptown. And then Waiting on a Friend is like, okay, you're at 135, you know. Yeah, you're at 137.
It sounds almost like Charlie's banging on garbage can lids.
Yeah.
You remember those those old aluminum garbage cans from the 70s?
Yeah. And then, you know, you finally make it there and you're at 136th Street and you're waiting on a friend. I mean, it's just.
Yeah.
Wow,
man. Tattoo You coming from Patrick Ivanetsky.
I figured I'd knock your socks off with that one.
Wait till I hear about this at the office.